This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more, and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement and the Rise Above Justice Movement the podcast. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. All right, so welcome to the podcast. Today, I am joined by my new friend, Elle. Elle, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we talked quite a bit about, you know, different angles that we could bring your podcast episode from, and I'm really excited to talk about this because there's so many different intersectional spaces, right? Because we know that trauma, we know that healing, we know that survivorship, we know that justice is complex. And part of this podcast is bringing the trauma-informed approach, you know, those content warnings and the trigger warnings, you know, we bring that in very heavily. But I'm excited to sit down and talk to you. It is an absolute honor. And, you know, I will turn it over to you. Feel free to, you know, introduce yourself to our audience and walk us through a bit of who you are, your background, a little bit about your story, and then we'll do some deep dives into different topics.
Sounds good. So I'm Elle. I'm a sexuality educator and sexologist. And a lot of this just comes from the experiences I had when I was young and just kind of wanting to give young people the tools and the skills to advocate for themselves, especially about sex and sexuality, because it is something that most adults will shy away from or are too scared to discuss. But it's something that really needs to be discussed with young people to give them the tools so they know how to keep themselves safe. Because we know there's just so much happening, and especially on a digital world and in a digital landscape. There is just too much content out there, and it's really difficult for adults to navigate it. And so young people need that help and support to navigate it as well.
You know, whenever I think about exactly what you just said, I think about the bullshit in the sex ed curriculum that states about abstinence only, right? So I grew up in Missouri, where it is very heavy abstinence only. And it doesn't teach about bodily autonomy. It doesn't teach about consent. It doesn't teach about, you know, sexual assault or trauma. And I've come to realize that, you know, the older that I get, the more that I think back and I look at what the schools are teaching now, and it's literally the exact same. Now, keep in mind, I'm 29 years old. So I went through the school system starting in probably like 2000 and like 2002 until 2015. So, you know, like that whole time, it felt like a absolute eternity. But and I know anybody who's gone through a public school system and exactly what I'm saying, or just gone through school systems in general, because it feels like an absolute eternity. Because, well, you know, it practically is. It feels like. But you're actually from Australia.
Yes, I am. And I mean, I think we tended to have a better sex ed curriculum than what I have heard about in the US. And even some of the curriculum that I'm teaching. So the one that I'm mainly using is actually from the 90s, and it started as kind of this abstinence only or abstinence kind of focus. And it still is, which is unfortunate, but it's also kind of that foot in the door, knowing that, you know, there is always going to be someone kind of in the school, an administrator, a teacher, even parents that are hesitant to give their children this information. And the interesting thing is some of the responses that we've gotten is that parents are upset because their young people now know more than they do about their own body. And that's kind of just that result of that abstinence based is you're not giving people actual tools. Whereas if you're able to talk about kind of your body and pleasure and kind of the capabilities that exist, there is a more realistic understanding of, okay, what is going to feel good? What is possible, and not just what do I need to prevent?
So you said a very key thing right there. What do I need to prevent? So let's talk about that. What does prevention look like in regards to sexual and gender-based violence? And from your perspective, what is the United States and, you know, just around the globe lacking whenever it comes to spaces of prevention, of preventing sexual abuse and sexual assault and domestic violence, et cetera? What are you seeing from your perspective and given your background?
This is also interesting because I'm doing another degree because I yearn for knowledge, and it's based in Sweden. So I'm getting kind of all around the world, and you know these issues are everywhere. There really is no place that there isn't gender-based violence or kind of issues of sexual assault and violence, which is. It's awful to think about, but there are definitely places that are doing it better. And I think, you know, prevention, it is a multi-prong approach because yes, you want people to have the tools to be able to recognize when something is wrong and get help, but you also want them to know what something good looks like. And that is the piece that has been missing from sex education for so long is just the idea that sex can be good and positive or like fun and enjoyable. And so there is a huge kind of shift in the sex education sphere where it's far more talking about pleasure and pleasure as being something that's important because it's like when you think about trying not to think about something. So if I say, don't think about a pink elephant, the image that immediately goes to your mind is a pink elephant. And we're not really giving kind of just a positive idea of what that can look like and even just what it could sound like.
Sorry, technological difficulties here. I'm not going to edit this part out because I believe in the authentic, but had a little bit of a functionality issue with Zoom. But you know, thinking about that and thinking about just the way that the world is right now, and especially here in the United States, because you know, Congress just voted to release the Jeffrey Epstein files, and it's been a long time coming. But I also am a little hesitant because how much of it has actually been completely redacted? You know, they've had a lot of time to go through and redact the names, and you know, they kept giving these like bullshit reasons for not, you know, releasing the files. You know, survivors deserve justice. Survivors deserve to have that moment of peace, you know, and not have to literally fight all of the stuff that's going on. And it's just devastating. And, you know, as somebody who has sat down and interviewed two of the Epstein survivors, and I probably know close to like five or six others, it's different sitting down and hearing their stories versus watching them, you know, in a news interview or, you know, at a press conference. It is way different. like sitting down and actually talking to them, like hearing their stories in real time. Like it's definitely interesting to sit down and see. But, thinking about justice, right? Because justice looks different for each person. But before we
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
dive into that. I want to talk a little bit about sex after sexual assault or after trauma, like the hypo or hypersexuality. There's fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. I recently learned that what I experienced was fawning. I did not know what the term was until probably like a maybe like a year or so ago, or maybe like a little less than that. And I had a really good conversation with one of my therapist friends. She's not my therapist, but she was kind of like, talking to me, kind of figuring out like, my story and things like that. And she's like, "What you experience is a term called fawning." And I looked at her and I was like, "Huh?" So I did some research and I was like, "Oh, this makes entire sense," because we're oftentimes taught about fight, flight, or freeze, but mainly the fight or flight. And not realizing that there's two other pieces to that, and one that a lot of people do not know about it, again, is that fawning part. So I'd love for you to talk about, sexual pleasure after sexual assault and trauma, and what it can look like to each person, because it's very different, depending on that what that person truly experienced. Like I know that I discovered that I was asexual after my second sexual assault. Like I have no physical attraction to anybody. I can have a romantic partner. I just cannot have a sexual partner, and I haven't come across, like that stage of my healing just yet. I'm still in that healing journey because healing is not linear; it is complex, and I don't think healing is actually a destination for me. I think it's more of just growing and becoming who I want to be and overcoming that trauma. So, in your education, and if you talk to anybody, what about the sexual pleasure after sexual assault and trauma? Like, what does that look like?
This is such a great question. I will also want to say that sometimes the fight, flight, freeze, fawn, it's also sometimes fight, flight, freeze, and appease. So that appeasement piece. There's also kind of the flop piece that I've heard in kind of my own therapy and thinking about that as a very extreme version of the freeze, of it's kind of you're done, you're tapped out. There's no kind of consciousness, and that can be that heavy dissociative piece. But it really is going to depend on the person, and I think that's why it's so important that we kind of take this more pleasure focused standpoint, especially just knowing how extensive kind of the statistics are for sexual assault and like child sexual abuse that is reported, and thinking about how broad it probably is. And just so many people experiencing that kind of focusing on that, okay, it can't look like this, it can't look like this. Where is the model for what it can look like? And so that pleasure focus really is just what feels good for you. What feels good for you by yourself? What feels good for you with a partner if that's something you're interested in? But really just trying to get people to focus more on some of the sensations and kind of like a mindfulness piece of being present in your body, which, if you have been through trauma, is a really difficult thing to do because so much of the time you are trying to escape your body as a protective mechanism so that you're not hurting yourself by experiencing what you're experiencing. And I think it can look so different. It is really common, and I think there's a lot of kind of controversy around kind of the concept of hypersexuality and even kind of compulsive sexual behavior and just what that can look like. And I think about my own journey, and it really was this measure of I want to take back control, knowing so much control has been taken from me. There's been no autonomy, there's been no choice, there's been no ability to kind of think about my own pleasure, that it was kind of just like, okay, I need to figure this out, not realizing I was just not present whatsoever. But it was this kind of very big desperation of, I need to be able to figure out what sexual pleasure looks like. And it's not something that I think is resolved, and it's something that'll be ongoing. And that I think most people should consider as ongoing, because, you know, bodies will change and people will experience different things. And some things that may have felt great for you previously won't feel good in the future. I think that also really connects to disability justice and knowing that, you know, we don't always have the same capabilities. I also am kind of dealing with my own endometriosis journey. And so like certain things that I used to enjoy, I'm just not, it's not going to feel good. And whether it might in the future, it's not really something that I know at this point.
Yeah, you know, thank you for sharing that, because I know endometriosis is definitely debilitating. It's definitely debilitating. I have several friends that are also going through it, and it is horrific. So, you know, sending all of my positive vibes towards you and anybody else out there who may be going and experiencing that as well. Now, I want to kind of shift just for a second and talk about what did pass in Texas, which is known as the Summer Willis Act. And it's a Texas law that redefines consent to close legal loopholes in sexual assault cases, specifically addressing issues with consent when a person is intoxicated or unable to communicate their agreement. It became effective on September 1st of 2025, and it clearly defines consent as a clear voluntary agreement through words or actions, and states that sleep, unconsciousness, or intoxication prevents consent. Now, why do I bring this up? Because it's important, because it was inspired by a survivor, Summer Willis. She is a sexual assault survivor who became an advocate after finding gaps in the law prevented her own case from being prosecuted. It did close a legal loophole. Before this law, Texas only recognized sexual assault in cases of involuntary intoxication, meaning a victim could only be protected if their attacker had physically drugged them or, you know, gave them alcohol or anything like that. It also provided a legal clarity. The law provides prosecutors with a clearer definition of consent to help hold more perpetrators accountable. Now, thinking about this, and I also think about the work that is happening in New York, because they had this exact same, you know, loophole that exists in the state of New York. So looking at a progressive state as the state of New York, looking at a conservative state as the conservative state of Texas, I'm seeing there's things happening across the board, right? In all 50 states, there's things that are happening. But the current law in New York does not define or give a clear definition of what consent actually looks like. And the bill was introduced in the New York legislature again and was shot down by the leader of the legislature. So I think about that and think about what kind of message that sends to survivors. And, you know, thinking about that, what's your reaction to those loopholes, and how can we continue to advocate as, you know, survivors, as concerned community members, to recognize the need to close these loopholes and help survivors gain more access to justice, whatever that may look like for them?
Yeah, I think it's very complicated. And I think that's where I have some frustration, is the legal system, the justice system, like, it's all very complicated and they don't really allow for a lot of nuance. And I think that the loopholes absolutely need to be closed, because it needs to be understood that consent does have to be something that is voluntary, that, you know, a person sleeping or a person that's intoxicated, they cannot consent. That is important. What I hear a lot from young people is the fears about what consent actually means, and especially knowing that it's something reversible, just feeling so worried about someone using that against them. And I think the kind of theme that I'm hearing is people are worried about someone thinking they're doing the wrong thing, and them not knowing, which is a very real thing because we're not honestly taught what consent really looks like. And I think there's a lot of good intentions behind talking about consent and all of the education about consent and the kind of shift from the no means no to yes means yes. But then it does kind of worry me about where is the room in the maybe part? Where is the room for, I'm actually not sure, but I want to see if I can explore this with you. And there's actually been quite a bit of research, I think mostly out of the UK. I know Emily Seddy has done a couple of them, talking about kind of young people and getting consent messages. And what we're hearing is and seeing in this research is that young people are, they know that there are more gray areas and they're aware of those. And people aren't really giving the answers for how to navigate those. And so when we give this very regimented, it has to look exactly like this. And I love the FRIES acronym. I think it's so important. And so that's FRIES for consent, which is freely given. So that's not coerced. There's no pressure. There's no threats or intimidation. It's R for reversible. So at any point, if a person becomes uncomfortable, they can say, I want to stop. I don't want to keep doing this. And so if someone says, yeah, I can do this. And then they later say, I don't want to, that I don't want to needs to be honored. The I is for informed. So that is making sure that you're on the same page about what's happening, whether that is kind of through the use of a condom, that condom stays on the entire time, or just what acts are going to be happening. And then enthusiastic, because you want someone to actually be wanting to have sex with you. When you're trying to have sex with them, it shouldn't be this kind of, oh no, I don't really want to. You want them to be like enthusiastic, to be wanting, like having that yes, and S as specific. So that's kind of specific to what something is and not kind of assuming, okay, you've given me consent, I can now just do anything. And so that's a really important acronym, and that's what we use to kind of teach young people what consent looks like. But we'll often get questions about like alcohol and drugs. And so much of the curriculum will say kind of refrain from alcohol or drugs because they impair your judgment, which is true. But young people kind of pick up what's in the media and what's happening in real life, which is that, you know, people will have a drink on a date and then maybe they'll go and have sex with someone. And they're asking, is that consent or is that clearly not consent? And it becomes very confusing when no one is explaining these things. And so we'll even talk about just so much of it is you're going to be in that gray area. So much of just being human is being in that gray area, but it's learning how to then talk to a partner and how to understand where they're coming from, what they're okay with, checking in with them. It's trying to have more conversations with people and normalize those conversations. And some of those can be really awkward because people don't want to face rejection. They don't want to hear no. Or people are afraid of what they want and they don't know how to say what they want. And so I think it's so necessary to close those loopholes, but I also am concerned about just how rigid some of these laws may be getting, because I do fear that there is going to become this kind of sense that you can't even ask and you can't have a conversation when really the whole point is there needs to be a conversation and just some kind of understanding of what you want to happen and what's okay and what's not. And that's not even just kind of before any kind of sexual behaviors or activity happens. That should be happening like throughout, like checking in and observing kind of from someone's body language, are they actually okay with this? Does it seem like they're enjoying this? If it doesn't seem like they're enjoying this, maybe I might ask, hey, are you okay? Do you need to stop? Do you want to take a break? And just kind of realizing that it's not going to look like what young people are seeing in the media in like short snippets in a movie or in pornography, which is pretty much everywhere at this point.
And then you have states like Kansas, where I currently live, that requires photo identification or selfie identification in order to access pornographic websites. And there are a lot of ways around that directly, and it's very interesting, to say the least. Now, I want to talk about something that I haven't seen a whole lot of conversation around, and that is the sexual abuse that happens at border schools, okay? So, or board schools, my bad. Boarding schools, whatever like the appropriate direct term of that is, but there's one specifically that I think about, and it used to operate as an independent fundamental Baptist Christian boarding school located near Stockton, Missouri, and it functioned from 1990 until 2023. And this school was founded by James Clemenson. It originally opened in the state of Washington on an old Air Force base, but it moved due to problems with asbestos. In 1996, the school moved to Cedar County, Missouri, and when they arrived in the local area, they had several, or they held several small events such as blood drives and other charitable events. Serious allegations of the violent treatment and sexual abuse of students have been made. In May of 2003, an F3 tornado struck through the school and the cafeteria building roof was ripped off. In January of 2022, a Gabe's longtime physician, Dr. David Smock, was charged with 11 felonies relating to sex abuse crimes. In August of 2022, a Gabe was indicted over the transportation of a youth who had an order of protection against his mother. In October of 2023, the mother of a former student filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the Cedar County Sheriff James McCreary and the youth transport firm in federal court. In 2024, a federal court allowed parts of a lawsuit to proceed against a Missouri County's sheriff's office filed by a former student of a Gabe boarding school. The plaintiff, now an Indiana resident, alleged that deputies failed to investigate multiple reports he made as a teenager, including claims of rape and physical abuse. The school, which has since closed, is alleged to have operated a forced labor scheme involving students. The court denied a motion for total dismissal of the case, giving the plaintiff 30 days to amend the complaint to specify how the deputies may have benefited from the alleged trafficking venture. Now, whenever I read that, and whenever I think about it, I think back to first learning about what was happening at that boarding school, because it, like I said, it was going on for a very long time. And I am glad that it has shut down. But those survivors are going to have lifelong after effects from that trauma. And that's something that I want to talk about now and kind of shift. You know, what are you noticing? Like, if you talk to anybody else, like, just think about somebody else, like, in your life, or think about another survivor that you've talked to. What have you heard in regards to the after effect trauma and those lingering effects? Because you know that violence leaves rippling effects in our communities and in our lives. What's something that you have heard the most and something that you see most commonly?
I think some level of denial is probably the thing that I see the most, or kind of like self-gaslighting. I think a lot of people just don't want to come to terms with the fact that something has happened to them. And it is a really challenging thing. And I mean, I know that I did for the kind of like very early young abuse that I experienced, but even kind of getting older and just so much that occurs between kind of young people just beginning to have relationships. And on so many levels, there are instances that are not okay, where people are then kind of talking themselves out of the fact that they weren't okay with something. And I think that's one of the kind of major themes with particularly young women in colleges, that they'll kind of experience something and kind of go on to date someone and then come to terms with the fact that their first and kind of sexual encounter was not consensual and it wasn't something that they were okay with. But I think that denial piece is that main one. I think a lot of people just kind of go throughout their lives not realizing that they were harmed. And that they were hurt by something. And in that same way, I think a lot of people don't realize when they cause harm, or when something kind of could have gone better. And I think we are just so hesitant to talk about how people are feeling, because there is this idea that someone has to be right and someone has to be wrong. And there are instances where that is so, so clear. But I think there's also a lot of that kind of messiness. And it's something that is really hard to navigate. And I think in kind of longer term relationships, that might be more present, of just kind of barreling past something or kind of not really considering the hurt in some of these early encounters of like developing that relationship. Because I think it, you know, it feels like you can't hold on to something or you can't talk about something if it happened so long ago. But really, we should be kind of reflecting back on things as we get more information, to understand ourselves and understand what we want and what we want to do better at.
Yeah, and there's always room for improvement, right? And that's something that, you know, is continuously ongoing. Speaking of which, I would love to shift and talk about the United States versus your knowledge of Australia, right? So thinking about healthcare, thinking about population and, you know, systems versus culture, and thinking about that, what are some of the commonalities that you see between the United States and Australia, and also some of the differences? And those differences are going to go from Australia to the United States. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot more similarity than people kind of want to say. And I think particularly just the kind of a violent history, and the racism that it's kind of both countries are founded on, I think is something that might be acknowledged, but it's not often talked about. And I think people in Australia are thinking, okay, yeah, the US is terrible. And people in the US are thinking, oh, Australia is not that bad. When really they're both particularly bad. I just think it presents itself a little bit differently. And I mean, healthcare is kind of one thing that, you know, it is great to have universal healthcare. But the problem in Australia is that there is this kind of two-tiered system. And so, yes, there is kind of public healthcare, but then there's also private. And talking more to people about kind of their experience. And so I had dental healthcare through the Australian kind of public system up until I was 19. But then that goes, and it's almost like, well, now you don't have dental the rest of your life. Like, it's great, you can have it as a child, you won't have it the rest of your life, unless you have this private insurance. And it'll be talked about as if kind of the wait times of the public system are the problem. But I think it's really the fact that there is this two-tiered system, because if we had a single system, like healthcare would have to happen. But because there is this two-tiered system, it's kind of like, okay, you can't get this through the public healthcare system, you're going to have to go private. But in the same way, I think there are kind of more concessions there, in the same, like similar to how the US has had the Affordable Healthcare Act and Medicaid and Medicare, although just keeping up with the news and what's happening there is just absolutely devastating. And these impacts are not just going to kind of be soon. They're going to have longstanding impacts on health. I feel like that was a little bit all over the place.
No, it's perfect, because that's exactly what I was looking for, is, you know, kind of like talking about like different angles and different perspectives. And yes, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, I am disappointed to know that, you know, Congress did not extend the Affordable Care Act subsidies that lower the cost of premiums for marginalized communities and, you know, disabled communities that otherwise don't qualify for like Medicaid, because there are a lot of states like the state of Kansas that does not have Medicaid expansion. All of this can be taken care of with universal health care, aka Medicare for All. Now, I know that that's a, you know, anti-capitalism approach to it, but, and that's obviously who I am, like, because look what capitalism has gotten to us. But thinking about like the hypervigilance and the surveillance culture, and a little bit of like the disconnect that is there, you know, let's talk about that just for a second. So what does hypervigilance look like in that surveillance culture? Because, and there's a reason I'm saying this, because I use Signal. Okay. And I use Signal to communicate with people. There was a recent report as of, like, I think yesterday, which yesterday was 11/20/2025. Today is 11/21/2025. And it was found that FBI has been spying on some of the advocacy groups up on Signal. So, oh my God. And thinking about that and thinking about what that looks like, what's your reaction whenever I tell you that? And I'm going to do a deeper dive into it here in just a second. But let's think about that for a second, because think about the number of survivors that, you know, let's tie this back into like survivor culture and like rape culture, okay? The number of people that are using Signal, because it's supposedly encrypted, it's supposedly this, supposedly that. But, you know, whenever I tell you that, what is your like that gut reaction? Because thinking about it from a survivor standpoint and think about it from survivor, you know, aspects, right? What do you see with that? What's that gut reaction?
It's interesting because I think about it and I'm like, okay, there is a kind of surveillance culture, but who are we surveilling and for what for? And I say we, but it's not us. It's, you know, there are so many people that will have horrible kind of messages that are sent to them. Those are not the ones being surveilled.
As we found out, you know, sending literal war plans on Signal.
Oh my goodness. Sometimes I wonder, are things kind of one of my many vivid dreams that I've had, or is this reality? Because it just, truth is stranger than fiction. And
Is
it's
reality.
just.
It is seriously reality, and it's going to continue being more hyper surveillance. And we have Congress members that are pro like surveillance. Like they want to be in every single aspect of our lives. And I know a couple of them right off the top of my head. I will not mention them, but there are a couple of them that I can think of right off the top of my head that are either, you know, former FBI agents herself or former police or former CIA agents or former, you know, just people that have been involved in those systems, and they're used to that surveillance and that constant watching people. But I can't help but think, you know, if somebody is trying to seek help for getting out of a situation, think about what people could be seeing. You know what I mean? And like finding out somebody's like plans of escaping their trafficker or their abuser, you know, and the question is, can that be used in court, right? Like, honestly, I'm honestly not entirely sure, because usually social media, which, you know, Signal technically counts as like a social media app or, you know, like a communication app, a lot of the times those are not viable use in court. So I don't know. And the way that things are structured right now, I honestly do not know, because I know how these systems are. So thinking about that, and I talked a little bit about this on a previous episode, and I would love to get your perspective on this. And it's purity culture versus rape culture. And are they the same or are they different? What's your thoughts?
That is an interesting point. I do kind of want to go back into the hypervigilance and surveillance culture, but I also want to tie that into healthcare because I think that's kind of the next step that it's going into. And I think that's coming from that capitalist sense of kind of if they can surveil messages or all the kind of health data that people have on like Apple Watches or health rings, how are they going to use that against people in the name of capital? Because it's all about capital. And the thing is, I love that you said that single payer healthcare is kind of inconsistent with capitalism, whereas there is an argument that it would be helpful because if you have a healthy functioning population, then you would have kind of better productivity and a better workforce. I do not support capitalism, but I do always kind of think about those arguments, and I think we've used them pretty successfully for some public health initiatives that, you know, there needs to be some semblance of health for people to actually be able to do work. But I think we're past the point of them caring about that at all. And it's not even about whether it's good, it's just how much money they can accrue. And I think that's part of where that surveillance culture is coming in, because it's really just trying to have data to kind of control everyone. It's not even about like production at this point. It is just purely about control. And that's what both purity culture and rape culture are to me, are measures of control. And I think purity culture is, it's part of rape culture. It's part of kind of just the patriarchy and living under that, where there is this violent quality to it. And I think I even kind of connect it to this idea of kind of a scarcity culture of like things are scarce, which has happened in the way that kind of so much has been exploited. But we really, if we could have something where not everyone is kind of competing for time, energy, and attention, and people are just able to get that, I think the world would be a better place. And it's so, so difficult for survivors just kind of living in the world as it is, because so many things are competing for their time, attention. And they really need to focus that on themselves, just kind of reconnect with themselves. I think that is the hardest part. And that is what the intention behind so many of these things are, is to control and disconnect people from their own bodies and their own kind of sense of who they are and what they want.
Exactly. That's why I wanted to talk directly about this, because oftentimes we see very commonalities in purity culture and rape culture, and then we realize that they're not actually really that much different, if literally any at all. And I've talked to a couple other like sexologists and, you know, like intimacy coaches and, you know, life coaches, and they tell me what they hear from their clients is, they're like, I didn't realize that what I was growing up in is completely wrong and not what the actual world looks like. And it's so, it also kind of ties into like religious trauma too. You know, it ties directly into that. And that is something that is also very common amongst survivors, is the, you know, that religious trauma that goes into that too. So thinking about like restorative justice, okay? Like the alternatives to reporting to police, and there's a really good organization called Survivors for Justice Reform that is led by Marley, and she lives in Canada, but she's a survivor that turned her rage into action. And now she's helping survivors figure out about justice reform and what it can look like. Now, this looks different in each place. These are for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors and also human trafficking survivors to understand the perspectives of the alternatives to reporting to police. Do you know anything about restorative justice?
I have bits and pieces of restorative justice. I think I've done kind of a lot of research into it, but also transformative justice and kind of thinking that about a lens of how I want to view the world.
So what, based off your knowledge and what you understand, what are some of those alternatives to reporting to police that you notice in transformational justice and restorative justice? I always struggle, you know, I'm used to saying RJ and TJ, and I gotten used to saying that because I'm like the Kansas rep for Survivors for Justice Reform. So I, you know, I'm getting ready to start like organizing Kansas around Survivors for Justice Reform. But, you know, thinking about those alternatives to reporting to police, you know, what's your thoughts based on the research that you've done?
I mean, I think it's really, it's complicated, and it's kind of that case by case. And that restorative justice is kind of focused on kind of the survivor and what they need, kind of from the perpetrator, the person that caused harm, and what they kind of need from themselves as well, and what supports that they need. And I think of transformative justice as more about the systems. And I think the kind of individualized approach is needed, and the systems also need to change. And so when I think about kind of transformative justice, it makes me think about kind of prevention on a different level. And so my father was one of the kind of main people that abused me, and it was horrific. And it's also learning about him, because I had this very complicated relationship with him where it was, I was being abused by him, but it was also the kind of close parent kind of relationship that I had. My mother kind of hated me, and still kind of, I think, was almost in competition with me over my father. And I think that's kind of partially why she kind of took his side and was willing to support him, but kind of not understanding kind of the harm that I was experiencing. But I think about my father, and I learned kind of as I got older about the abuse that he endured. And it was not by his father, to my knowledge. But part of it was that he grew up with a padlock on his refrigerator, and they did not have access to food. And so in his story, he kind of made friends with this boy that had access to this big house with a full fridge. And my dad, being hungry, kind of let this person do other things just so that he had access to food. And I think about how that became normalized to him, and just how much would be different if that didn't happen.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's something that needs to be discussed more, is a lot of perpetrators are also survivors themselves. And thinking about that, and thinking about that restorative justice piece, because that's kind of like where that kind of like ties into a little bit. And, you know, like the prevention aspect, but also the post-prevention. You know, whenever I think about post-prevention and prevention, I think about suicide prevention as well, and like mental health, because the intersectional approach of survivors and also going to therapy and mental health, it can look very challenging, especially in like rural areas that don't have necessarily the best resources, or lack, or it has literally the lack of resources in a lot of rural areas. So thinking about, you know, I'm going to pivot here just for a second. We're kind of going all over the place, and I'm loving this, because it shows like how complex these topics really are, right? And I love just kind of like picking pieces apart and just talking about it for a second, adding commentary, and then moving on to the next thing, because it shows, you know, getting those thoughts out, right? So one of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about is like algorithms and filters on social media and US versus Australian media. I have had followers of the Rise Above Justice movement based in Australia that see more American media than we do. And they know what is happening in America more than we do. And oftentimes they find out before we do. And it's really interesting. So thinking about that, and thinking about the mainstream media, what's your thoughts on that?
It's interesting, because I feel like some of the major like media conglomerates may be even owned by the same kind of people in the US and in Australia. But it is interesting that Australia will get kind of some news from the US before people in the US do. And I even think that happens kind of all around the world, in that there is this, like, they don't want you to know what's actually happening around you locally. They want you to kind of see other places and kind of think, maybe it's this kind of reflective, like, oh, it's so terrible there, it's much better here, so you don't get up and do something. I do wonder about what the intentions of that are, but I think it is really this shift of people don't want you to know what's going on locally, because that's where you can have the biggest impact. And I think about it so much as it really does start in your own home. And so with my partner, it's kind of constantly talking about what like gender hegemony looks like, and how it plays out even just in interactions between us. And so much of that is just based on kind of how we've been socialized, and there's cultural aspects to that. There's also kind of place and like rural versus city, as well as kind of income levels and education. Like, there's so many different factors that go into that, but it really, everything does start at home.
You said a key thing. Everything starts at home. You said a very key thing. And one of the common things that I see is parents blaming the schools. That is something that I have seen, or blaming video games. Like, obviously, yes, those do contribute to that. I understand that. But at the same time, let's address that root problem, right? Think about the pharmaceutical companies, okay? Think about that just for a second and think about how pharmaceuticals function. They function off of profit, right? Because it's easier to work on the symptoms of somebody's illness versus addressing the cause of that illness. You know what I
Yeah.
mean? And thinking about the for-profit healthcare system and thinking about, just the other systems that exist, the criminal justice system, they're working exactly how they were designed. Oftentimes we hear that a system is broken, but my question is it or is it really functioning by design? I think about that, and it's something that I struggle trying to comprehend and trying to understand. And I've been doing this advocacy work for close to 16 years now, and I have still yet to find the answer. But I'm working on a research project that's going to show about policing in America, and I'm going back from 1900 to current. And what I am finding is horrid. Is literally horrid. And I cannot find the exact words of how I feel looking at these stories and reading the research on this, but I can't help but think about the aspects of the criminal justice system from a global perspective, considering we are one in 2024, the United States was one of the only 15 countries that carried out executions, according to Amnesty International. I think about survivors that have been executed and survivors that have also been, faced by capital punishment. Whew. And doing this research and doing these deep dives into these topics, it is very interesting to say the least. And I'm going to leave it on that. I'm going to die on that hill just for a second. But let's think about some more of like your own like experiences. What has healing looked like for you? Because we know that healing is not a one-step journey. And do you feel like healing is a destination for you, or are you kind of like, this is where I'm at, this is where I want to go, and it's okay not to have that destination? But what does healing look like to you, or growth has looked like to you?
This is such a great question.
And feel free to also elaborate on this and do a deep dive into this, because this is the part of the podcast episode that really hits hard for people. So this is where you can absolutely talk the most about.
I mean, I feel like healing for me, it seemed like something that was so kind of far off in the distant future. And I have a great therapist now, and I love her so much. I don't know where I would be without her, but I think about the kind of progress that I've had and I've been able to make with her. And I barely recognize the person that I was when I started. And that's not to say I've kind of become a completely different person, but I think about how much was closed off to me and just what I was not able to see for myself. And I quite often will talk to her about the fact that I truly feel like I'm just making things up as I go right now, because I had kind of goals and dreams, but I never thought they would come to fruition. I thought I was going to I thought I wouldn't be alive to have my first period. I did not think I was going to make it. And each kind of birthday I have, I'm still just kind of shocked that I'm like, oh, okay, we made it another year. Cool. Wasn't expecting that. And I think it is just healing is that kind of constant practice. And I'll have times that I feel like I'm doing a lot for myself and I'm feeling really good about myself, and other times that feel much harder, but it's still part of the healing. And I think every time I kind of handle a challenge, I feel like that's part of a healing as well, because it's something that I didn't think I would get to. And even when I'm going through a really difficult time, it's kind of even that is healing, because it's not the same as what I was going through. Growth is something that I'm kind of obsessed with the idea of, and I think sometimes it is growth is being comfortable where you are and accepting that. Because so often we're kind of looking into the future, looking into the past, and just not able to kind of sit and realize where we are in the present. And I think as I've kind of been on this healing journey, I'm having more moments of kind of being able to recognize where I am and the younger parts of myself being able to kind of see that. And I had an instance where I was kind of cooking in my kitchen and kind of singing along to Florence and the Machine, and I was just sobbing. And it wasn't this sobbing from kind of anything bad happening, but it was kind of just in disbelief that I like have my own apartment and I have a job that I love and I'm doing work that I care about and I have a partner and I have three beautiful cats. And just kind of thinking about how none of these things felt possible for so long. And I am absolutely terrified to lose any of them because it is life-changing to experience good things after trauma, I think. And it seems impossible, but it you kind of just gotta keep showing up. You just gotta keep showing up day after day, and something will change. And it took a very, very long time. It took a very, very long time, but it did.
Thank you so much for one, talking with me today on the podcast, but two, for also being authentic and bringing your whole self to these conversations. Because honestly, I think talking about these issues and talking about our own healing journeys also helps others heal too. And it lets people know that they are not alone, and it lets people know that it does look different for each person. And what may not have, or what may have worked for me may not have worked for you. And what worked for me may not have, wait, I just said that. Apologies. This is the point of the podcast where I get a little delulu. But, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and just bringing your whole soul to this, because I think bringing awareness to what healing looks like, and it's okay not to have a destination. Because we know that healing, again, is not linear. It is complex. And sexual and gender-based violence is really hard to overcome, especially the generational trauma that comes with it and how it leaves those rippling effects in families and communities. And whenever our elected officials refuse to address those ongoing issues, what does it do? It fails future generations. We also have the thing that is titled as boys will be boys. That is what I learned. And I, in the locker rooms in school, I would hear boys talking about just different things that they were going to do to their girlfriend this weekend. And it's like, oh my God. So, whenever you were talking about that, it starts at home, that is something that you're absolutely correct on, because it does. And thinking about how social media has kind of played a role in some of that, and also just, oh God, there's so many problematic, like, YouTubers, there's problematic, political commentators. I think about the influences of what our younger generations have and what they see. And I know what I grew up with, which I grew up looking at, like, Westboro Baptist Church on social media, which I don't know if you know anything about them, but they are literally a cult and they are horrific. So, I'm thinking about some of those influences and thinking about the current state of everything. Is there anything else you wanted to share with the audience today, or do you want to share, like, any type of, like, inspiration or what's next for you? And then also how people can follow you on social media and, like, kind of, like, uplift the work that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I have my Instagram, abolitionist sexology, which is I
Yes.
sparsely will post there, because I think I'm still I'm so internal and so much is just kind of swirling through my mind, and then eventually I get something out on kind of paper, and I want to hear what other people have to say and their perspective and kind of have these kind of conversations. So this is just a wonderful thing that you're doing, and I really appreciate it. And knowing that, hearing other people's stories, it was one of the most kind of transformative things for my own kind of journey. And I appreciate everyone that puts themselves out there and is authentic and vulnerable to that. It is just a way to connect with other people. I think also with young people, what they're dealing with these days, like, we are all kind of, all the adults are absolutely shocked and horrified with what is going on. And I think there's a lot of blame with young people of kind of, oh, it's because they're on their phones, or like, they're doing all these things. There is so much out of their control that they just have to deal with. And already adults feel like the world is out of control and they don't know how to deal with it. And it is hard, but it is our responsibility as the adults to kind of have that empathy for young people and the younger generations, and to be supportive in the sense that we're giving them autonomy and choice and letting them make the choices for themselves. We don't want to make choices for them. We want to kind of hear what they want and let them make their own decisions. And I think that's kind of one of the key things that we will talk about, is adultification and kind of the assumed kind of adult qualities of young people. And that also ties into kind of this adult supremacy concept, which is that so many adults think that they know best for what young people need. And if we all kind of think back to when we were young, adults were doing that to us too, and it was not helpful. Like having someone tell you, no, you have to do this and this, and even kind of the people that were saying, oh no, you have to get a STEM degree or you have to go into computer science because that's where the jobs are. And now seeing kind of AI is coming out, and you know, so many jobs are being lost because of this, and people are absolutely devastated because they put, they gave the adults in their life so much credit and said, okay, I'll do what you tell me to. And then they're miserable and kind of not able to pivot because they committed so strongly to something that someone has kind of prescribed for them. And we really just need to listen more to what young people want. And I think a lot of what we're hearing is that they want a better world, but also those algorithms are really sending them down some dangerous paths. And the right-wing influences that exist out there and kind of the different ways that they will present online, it is all very palatable to the algorithms, and it's all kind of being sold to us in different forms. And I think it's just so important to remember that none of us are immune to propaganda. It is sneaky, it is pervasive, it is taking all of the kind of knowledge that we have about what works and what kind of what media works, what works in neuroscience, it is taking all of those and using that against you. And so just, we all need to be really critical of the things that we consume. And like, is anyone, does anyone have all the answers? Absolutely not. But we all just kind of need to have more open conversations and being willing to listen to each other. And it can be really hard to have some of those conversations. And my partner will often kind of try to end conversations when it's getting something controversial, because he knows I am very much going to have a difficult conversation and push people on some of their kind of beliefs. But I don't think we're going to get anything to change unless we are having some of those conversations. I mean, we need to take care of ourselves first and foremost, because you can't do anything if you're not taking care of yourself. But having some of those conversations, even when they're challenging, I think it gives the humanity back in, because we are very quickly dehumanizing people. And I think that is, for me, where I think a lot of the root of these issues are, is the willingness to dehumanize people so quickly. And that really kind of ties into that transformative justice, and even just kind of the concept of the death penalty, is we have completely dehumanized someone completely based on a behavior and decided that that's a referendum on who they are as a person.
Mm-hmm.
I can no longer deal with them. And I mean, so much of it is down to power dynamics, because I don't know what to do with people that have so much power and are doing such awful things. Like, I don't know what the solution is there, but I don't think this chronic kind of dehumanization is the answer.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. 100%. Everything you just said is absolutely spot on. And, again, thank you so much for bringing your whole energy to this conversation because this has been very enlightening for me. And I am very excited to continue, on the conversations. And, you have an open invite. And I feel like you and I could talk literally for like hours about these issues. So there might be a series sometime down the road that, we do these deep dives into restorative justice and transformational justice.
I would be so down to do that.
I think it's such a interesting perspective, just to really continue bringing light to these issues that don't reach those headlines, right? And that's part of what the podcast that we have created does is it shines a light on the stories that go untold or that don't reach those headlines because mainstream media is literally complicit in silence. And
Oh, completely.
complicity means compliance. Compliance means failing your future generations in your marginalized communities. And also saying that, people like my mom, who is going through cancer treatments and she's disabled, but she's also a survivor herself, saying that she doesn't deserve to have access to her health care. Then there's a very real reality that one day we will wake up and realize she doesn't have health care anymore, along with millions of other people. Now, she qualified for Medicaid expansion in the state of Missouri. So there's extra layers of protection to like eliminating her health care because she's not bound by like ACA or anything like that. However, that state and in the legislature or the governor, because he is a fascist, he can literally eliminate the health care at any time. That is a very real reality because they have this mentality of who's going to stop me? Who's go you know, who's you and what army? I mean, look at how many federal judges have overturned things that are happening and it's still continuously going. So it's literally, what's the point in having a court system if we're not going to abide by it? What's the point of having the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, but they're siding with a, oh God, a regime that is literally trying to destroy people like my mom, right? I just think about that and I think, this is all by design. I read Project 2025 and I was deeply horrified by what I read and looking at this quote unquote big beautiful bill. And the more we learn about it, the more we realize it's big beautiful bullshit. And I've come to realize that. And there's some very deep cuts to crucial programs that literally keep communities thriving and literally keep communities alive. So we're not a Christian nation. We're not a pro-life nation. We are pro-surveillance and pro-control because that's what it's all been about. But anyway, that's a whole different topic for another episode. But again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And I greatly appreciate you. And please take care of yourself as best as possible, whatever that looks like for you. And I will see you around.
You so much for having me. I really would love to talk to you for hours and hours. I just think there's so many different kind of pockets of kind of information and just kind of conversations that we could have. And I just truly appreciate all the work that you're doing, and for having this platform that you do.
Absolutely. You have contributed to that platform. Thank you very much. I appreciate you. You take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you as well.